Hello and welcome back to Album with me, Arslan Mohammed. In this episode, it's part two of my conversation with musician, producer, Manchester punk pioneer and Berlin icon, Mark Reeder. And here, we really get into the heart of Heroes and explore Mark's fascination with the album's infusion of Berlin blood and soul. Heroes, as you know, was released in September 1978, and it was made here in the city where Mark had just arrived. He came to find a bleak, dark, schizophrenic metropolis, which was fueled by a vibrant underground music scene, which embraced the young Mancunian as he began to collaborate with renegade East and West Berliners. And if you haven't seen the film B-Movie, you should check it out. It's called B-Movie. It's on DVD and Blu-ray, came out about 10 years ago. And it's a wonderful semi-documentary retelling of Mark's early years in West Berlin. And there's tons of amazing music. And it really gives you a flavor of what the city was like at the time. But of course, Heroes helped shape Mark's view of the city, and it and Berlin, which is still his home and mine too, has remained close to his heart ever since. So of course, in this episode, we explore its wider context, which is Weimar-era art, post-war Berlin, cabaret, Kraftwerk, Tangerine Dream. We're going to dig into each track here, turning over the rocks and stones and finding all sorts of strange and wonderful little creatures wriggling beneath. So enjoy this episode and keep an ear out. We'll have the final part of this conversation ready for you very soon. Here we go.
Wish you could swim.
And in the scene, Bowie on Matt Bolan, Bowie performing Heroes for the first time on Matt Bolan. And that was like an indication of what was going to be coming up. Like, I just thought it was just going to be a single because they'd already released, at the beginning of the year, already released Like Low. Now a day that it's going to release a new album. Another new album comes out in the same year. That's even more overwhelming somehow than Low, you know, like it was like, wow, this is like
he's on a roll.
Yeah, it's like that. He's gone from Low, and Low was brilliant, you know, to this, you know, it was a real shock, yeah, a pleasant shock, you know. I was like thrilled. After that, then came Stage.
This trajectory, which had begun with Low, which was this very European sound and lots of electronica and a new sort of experimental mindset. This was something that really coincided with you arriving in Berlin in 78.
Well, you know, the fact that he'd made the record here in Berlin, and also he'd done the two Iggy albums as well.
Yes.
You know, well, he'd done one Iggy album, I think, by that point, hadn't he? And it was like been working here, and they'd made like two fantastic records, you know. Berlin had always been this kind of like that place that nobody really knew anything really about. It's a bit alluring in a way, you know, like politically. What's it like, East and West? But it was so far away. It wasn't like you just could just nip off in a car and go there or something. It was so far away. It was in the middle of East Germany. When I got to like as far as Hamburg, I realised it's not very far now. I'm closest I'll ever get, so I'm going. and then, like you say, I arrive in what essentially is Heroes Berlin, you know. '76, '77, '78, that was what Bowie was experiencing. It was like I arrived at the tail end of that, you know.
And do you hear that in the album? So you hear that on the album?
For me, it's the soundtrack.
Yeah.
As side two of Low is the soundtrack. For me, it's a continuation of the second side of Low and the whole of Heroes is for me, like, it's like a complete soundtrack of Berlin era.
Yeah.
Everything. And it's like, if you have the instrumental intro, then you have the vocal kind of middle part and then an instrumental outro somehow. That's how I listen to it. Heroes just kind of just set the bar somehow. Then working with Brian Eno and knowing that Brian Eno had made an album with Cluster, it was like a couple, actually, of the albums with Cluster. No, you know, it was obvious that if he's going to be working with Eno, some of that is going to rub off.
So it's kind of, all these strands were connecting, all these things were coming together.
It was like that. It was like the whole kind of concept of David Bowie as Ziggy Stardust seemed to be so far removed away from what he was doing with Low and Heroes, you know. Didn't he make the Man Who Fell to Earth before he made Low?
That was before.
It was before, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And I think that moment, there was some kind of game-changing moment there somehow, like where...
The whole Thin White Duke period, you feel, was a sort of...
It closed.
It closed one period and another period.
And then he kept... Yeah. And he was kind of showing that he wanted to go in a different direction, and it wasn't a particularly commercial direction. He was pushing the boundaries of commercial music because he knew he had a following, a huge following of fans, and he was seeing how... You know, he'd always, like from the very beginning, had a few years of one thing and changed into something else and done something else. And I think that this was just another way of saying to his fans, check this out, you know, try this out. This German music has influenced my way of musical way.
And this is what I love.
Yeah.
Heroes, by all accounts, Visconti, Antonio Mas, the people who were around him, was that he was in a really good place when he recorded this. Now, the album, like you said, has got this, we all feel this sense of the Berlin night, but by all accounts, Bowie himself was super confident and a really creative burst of energy. Well, just done Lust for Life.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And there's a fascinating fact I discovered, I think, on Chris O'Leary's blog. In the studio with Iggy to do Lust for Life, he noticed how Iggy would pretty much extemporize. He would just kind of leave it to the last minute and make up things on the spot.
Yeah, yeah.
And Bowie thought, well, I fancy a bit of that.
I'd do that better, yeah.
So Heroes began pretty much with just scraps.
I was just going to say, it's like, that's probably the thing about the difference between Heroes and Low is the fact that it was like more or less spontaneous everything.
Yeah.
It was all left till the last minute. Even, you know, like getting Robert Fripp to come over was like, can you come to the studio and just play on my record? Had no idea what he was letting himself in for. Gets off the plane and the first thing he does is the first track that he's played.
Well, I was going to say, this brings us perfectly to Beauty and the Beast.
Beauty and the Beast. He was Beauty and the Beast as the first track. You know, plugging his guitar into like the synthesizer with Ryan. And so you're just thrown in at the deep end. And that's how confident he was. Confident enough to know that he could make an album like this. It was almost like cut and paste of like the lyrics of the 70s somehow gone onto another level.
Yeah.
And it was the whole thing.
This is a great way to get into this track. So we have Fripp who shows up, and like you say, he's presented with the bare bones of it. And Visconti's talking about it and saying Fripp's guitar was sent through various effects pedals, and the last pedal led into Brian Eno's EMS Synthy, which was that little briefcase.
The suitcase.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
It was just that, really. And they just, like you were saying, they just said to him, okay, here we go, 1, 2, 3, boom. And he didn't know what he was doing. So.
Yeah.
But it comes out brilliantly. And I think that track, it's described as cabaret disco. Because it's got this dark and light in it. You've got Carlos Alomar playing this incredibly funky riff all the way through with the tambourine and the funky riff. And then you've got Fripp squawking and skronking and screeching over the top. And then this absolutely demented lyric.
And it's crazy.
Yeah.
It's like,
but it sets the tone perfectly, doesn't it?
You listen to that and it's like the connection to Berlin. Mm. It's like, where does it lie, really?
Yeah.
You know, in Beauty and the Beast. It's like, for me, like I look at that track and it's like, that's our dual city.
Yeah.
You know, it's Berlin for me, Beauty and the Beast.
I think that they had the backing singer, Antonia Maas, who they'd found in a nightclub. And she just drops in these wonderful lieblings in the backing, which is just, it's pure cabaret, isn't it? It's like something out of the 1920s, but throw it into this mix.
And I think
it just makes it.
The film Cabaret was also like really influential. Yeah. And the fact that, you know, this was something that even in my teenage years, you know, Cabaret was like really the only thing we really knew about Berlin. Mm. If you knew anything at all, you know, it was like this film, which was even just a fictitious movie, really, you know, based on Christopher Isherwood's book, but it was still like, you know, Cabaret, you know. That film too probably had some colouring in this whole scenario, you know, because let's face it, he didn't live very far away from where Christopher Isherwood used to live.
Were you a fan of Isherwood's books?
I've read Goodbye to Berlin,
Mr. Norris, You had the Sally Bowles chapter in Goodbye to Berlin, which they then used as I'm a Camera, which was, I think, John von Druten was the author of that.
Yeah.
Then they created the film Cabaret. So it went through a couple of iterations. But what I loved about Isherwood's writing, and Bowie's talked about Isherwood a lot, it's a very sort of straight, hence I Am a Camera, photographic, realist style of writing. Mm. But in the background, you can discern various sinister currents and, you know, shadows emerging, the Nazis coming in, the gradual shift to society, this sort of doomed underground, decadent nightlife. All of it's there and it's wonderfully evoked.
A book like that, which, you know, the Weimar Republic was Germany like after the First World War? Post-First World War Berlin, I think that was probably really the attraction.
Absolutely.
For Bowie. And having read Isherwood's books and then seeing the film Cabaret and then also being interested in Entartekunst, you know, the forbidden art of Nazi Germany, I think that these things like played into the whole allure, if you like, of like being here.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know how much Bowie, while he was living in Los Angeles, thought about what life could be like if he moved to Berlin at any point. I think that came after he had decided to come here to do Low, because no one had been here before. And I think when he'd been on the train, he'd done the Trans-Siberian Express. I think that the fact that in Berlin he got a reception, there were some people kind of waiting for him at Bahnhof Zoo. And I think that was like, maybe, I think he might have thought, maybe I should just come here and check it out a little bit longer.
I mean, there were definitely a number of converging circumstances. I mean, his growing interest in German music, that had been going on since, say, 75 or so with Kraftwerk.
Probably earlier.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I discovered like Faust and bands like this in like 1972. And I'm sure that if I'm working in a record shop and listening to this kind of music, I'm pretty sure that David Bowie heard about it as well. You know, I don't know how much he was impressed by something like that. You've got Faust and you've got Cannes and various other people kind of making these very experimental, almost classical pieces of music. You know, there isn't hardly any lyrics to work out. And if it was, it was always something which was a bit ambiguous or whatever. It wasn't like they were making songs. You know, Tangerine Dreams, early albums, they're all very, very experimental. There's no tune, there's no song, structured kind of like presentation of any kind of pieces of music that are on these albums. The first Tangerine Dream albums, like a load of blips and blanks, really, you know. I thought Joe the Lion was like the most bizarre song on, like, lyrically on Heroes. It's like, at first I had no idea what he was talking about and singing about, and it was only years later that I discovered he was singing about some performance artist, I think it was
Chris Burden.
Yeah,
he nailed himself to a cow.
Yeah. And I'm like, okay, so that's what it's all about. It wasn't anything to religion or anything. Have you heard of the Jim Rose Circus?
Yes.
Yeah. When I realised what the actual lyrics actually meant and where the background came from, it reminded me of that. That was like, it's like something like someone probably would have performed in the Jim Rose Circus. Yeah. Nailing himself to a cross.
He was quite a distinctive artist. And he was very much of his time. So he had a piece called Transfixed, where he was literally nailed to the roof of a VW Beetle. And then he also had a piece called Shoot.
Was that one where he got shot?
Yes, exactly. So,
yeah, it's kind of, your career could be short-lived if someone's about
to break. Short-lived. You mentioned the melody, and the melody and the lyrics are complete jumbles of chaos. He said, I had no melody when I started, so I only sang the lines I'd written for about 4 or 5 bars at a time. So he patched it together. Having sung one line, I take a breath and then do the same thing again, and so on to the end. I never knew the complete melody until I finished the song, then I played the whole thing back. So it was kind of feeling its way through the song for him as well. He didn't actually know how it was going to sound until the end. And I think this takes something we've been seeing since he started doing that Burroughs cut-up thing, I think around 73, 74, when he really started experimenting. This is almost like a kind of
A bigger version.
A bigger version of that, isn't it?
The whole song. It's not just the lyrics, it's the music and everything and the ideas and everything. And I think the whole album of Heroes is more or less like that.
Yeah.
In a sense, right? Because there's only like one or two tracks which are kind of like he did before or something, or had some kind of coherent idea.
This is another Robert Fripp appearance on this track as well. And Bowie said, for this track, so as we said just now on Beauty and the Beast, Fripp shows up. He's played some very basic elements and told just to go for it. On this track, Bowie says, the only premise that I gave him was to play with total abandonment and in a way that he would never consider playing on his own albums. I said, play like Albert King. And Fripp looked puzzled. And then he'd go in and try his damnedest to get somewhere near that. But it would come out his way.
Yeah.
So things like Joe the Lion were really him having a bash at the blues. So this was Fripp trying to approximate the blues, which is mental. Bowie said he was great like that. He really got into the swing of it. He loved the idea of me giving him an image or a guideline. It was his way of breaking what he normally does.
Yeah.
If he went in with his own set of methods, it would turn out to be recognizably Fripp. But I would throw him this spanner in the works and give him two more signposts as to where to go. And then he would say, all right, yep, I see what you mean. And he'd do something. So Joe the Lion was really, you know, shonky, you know, bodged together, stream of consciousness about this crazy artist, Chris Burden, and Fripp playing the blues.
It's fantastic.
Isn't that nuts?
Yes.
Yeah. There we go. Well, now we get to the big centerpiece of the album, the anthem, which...
The title track.
Delfina is chill. Niemand gibt uns eine Chance. Doch können wir sie dann für immer und immer. Und wir sind dann Helden. Für einen Tag.
Exactly. So you said you saw this the first time on the Mark Bolan show.
Yeah.
I did that.
I saw that for the first time. And it was also, again, a totally different Bowie. on stage.
How so?
You know, it wasn't the young Americans, David Bowie. It wasn't even the man who fell to earth, David Bowie. He was dabbling a little bit in rock and roll again, you know, because he's let's face it, it's his era, you know, he's a rock and roll kid, right? Totally dressed down, David Bowie, somehow. And that was like, okay. And then the song, you know, the song is like, and I don't know how close after finishing Heroes, David Bowie was actually on Matt Bolden's show or if it was in the middle. But when you hear the recording on TV, it's almost like as if they obviously had never played it before.
Yeah.
And it sounds very, it's very fresh.
Yeah.
You know, it's like we don't really know what's going on next. Someone trying to impersonate Robert Fripp's guitar. But it's a really interesting rendition of Heroes. And you can, you know, immediately it's like captivate.
Like dolphins can swim. Nothing will keep us together. We can beat them forever and ever. Oh, we can be heroes just for one day.
You know, once you saw the lyrics, you know, once you know what you read the lyrics and you know where he's been living, it kind of said, okay, you know, it's about the Berlin Wall.
Mm.
It wasn't about the Berlin Wall.
But we all thought it was.
You know, everyone thought it was about Berlin.
The symbolism, the lyrics was all very much about the wall, the guards
and all
shooting
that.
Over the heads.
It has got that too. Yeah, for sure it has. But you know, like the original kind of like idea that he's been living in Berlin and this is the song. You know, we all believe that this is just purely about that subject. But there's so many different levels with Heroes. It's not just one thing. It's not just about the guards shooting over our heads, you know. It's about all the things that are kind of like have been happening in his immediate environment, you know, with like his wife splitting up and all these things. And at the same time, the fact that he had been inspired by the art of Berlin, you know, like this like Weimar Republic images. There's this Tony Visconti story whereby it's apparently like if Bowie looks out the window and sees that Visconti having a kiss with Antonia Maas, and this has become the kind of legend of the story, really. But I don't think so.
I think in recent times that story has been debunked to quite an extent.
When I was doing the research for Peter Gilman and his book.
Sorry, I should just say, so Mark, you did research for, a lot of people listening would be familiar with Peter Gilman's book, which came out, I think, in the 80s.
It was yeah, 86.
86. So you worked as a researcher for him and you gathered information from the ground here in Berlin.
He asked me if I would help him then, because I knew Esther Friedman, so it was like that was our starting point and some stuff. And then you wrote
She's still living here in the 80s?
No, she'd already left by then. But she was living here when I came here. I met her. When I came here, and because I had that starting point too, he asked me if I would help him, help him to find out the people who's still alive and go and interview them and everything. In my research, I found out about this elderly gentleman who ran a small hotel on the Kurfürstendamm called the Askanische Hof Hotel. His name was called Arthur Vogt, and Arthur Vogt was a really colourful character. He was a really interesting person. Like he knew all the 1920s and 30s film stars because he was in the late sort of 20s and early 30s. He was the concierge of the Adlon Hotel. So he knew everyone from Hitler to Marlene Dietrich, everyone who'd ever passed through the doors of the Adlon Hotel back in the late 20s and early 30s, he knew. And after the First World War, he'd gone to America. And he smuggled alcohol coast to coast under his car, in kind of specially prepared compartments under his car. And because he was a German, he said that when the police stopped, he was a German, was travelling coast to coast in a car. No one ever gave it any thought that this German guy might be smuggling alcohol. And so he did that for quite a number of years. And then he came back to Berlin, and it was like, you think you're talking about the end of the 20s when economy of the city was pretty poor, you know. But he was working in the Adlon, was concierge. And his friends were Erich Heckel and
the painter.
Emil Nolde.
Yeah.
His friends were Erich Heckel and Emil Nolde. And it was very obviously gay. You know, he was very flamboyant in his art. And but he explained to me that he took David Bowie and Coco and Claire to the Lutzower Lampe in Charlottenburg.
The bar.
And introduced him to Carmen and everything. And he took some photos. He took photos of that and showed me his photos of like there. I'd never seen these photos before. We managed to get one of the photographs of Peter's book out of him. But he took them to the Brooker Museum, Claire and Bowie. He took them to the Brooker Museum.
Sorry, Claire is the artist.
Yeah,
Claire. Who was living in Berlin.
Yeah.
And she met Bowie and spent a couple of days with him.
I think, I don't know how long their relationship had been. I think he knew her from maybe somewhere before because she was British, right? So he knew her from somewhere else. But I think they had a quite pretty long friendship even before. She went with Bowie to the Brooklyn Museum, and they were looking at all the art there. And that's all the imagery incorporated in The Idiot, Iggy's pose, and Bowie's pose on the front of Heroes. Also, there was one specific painting of two lovers kissing by the wall.
Yeah.
The wall from 1920.
Right. Okay, yeah.
You know, a factory wall.
Yes.
It's in the Brooker Museum. You can see it. Go and look, see it. You know, it's like that was the inspiration. That was the inspiration. And the fact that he's making a record very close to the Berlin Wall is like an amalgamation of two ideas. You have the Berlin Wall as a kind of symbol of like political system divisions or whatever. And you have this image of this romantic image of two lovers in their 1930s gear, you know, like kissing to each other. And I think that there was those two things. He brought those ideas into this one song, you know. And then, of course, you know, well, having to bring it into the kind of like the present day scenario, then they create this mythology about, you know, Tony Visconti kissing Antonio Mas. But, you know, I think that the initial starting point was this painting in the Senior's Looking Museum.
That really does make sense. And the thing is, the song is so much about challenges and overcoming challenges and being faced with adversity. But at the same time, I mean, Tony Visconti's got a quote saying it's about a bunch of drunk, you know, it's a couple of drunks, you know, because he's... Or something like, you know, it's between two alcoholics.
You can imagine that too, you know.
Yeah.
But I don't think, you know, that necessarily is the narrative of the song for me personally, anyway. At least, you know, I think it's like he'd seen these things, and I feel really super privileged that I was able to go to the Brooklyn Museum and see the painting and understand the minute, you know, Arthur told me about this, about this particular story. Because Arthur believed that this was the painting which had given him this inspiration for this song. I immediately went there and had a look, you know. I wanted to see it for myself. And you see it in reality, you know. You realise, like, yeah, this is it. It was like suddenly the veil just came off.
Do you remember the name of the painter? When you had these conversations with Arthur, did anything else come up that was particularly striking? Any of his recollections that have really stayed with you or made an impression?
I don't know how well he knew Bowie, but Bowie would always check into the Askanischer Hof Hotel after checking into the Hotel Kempinski. The Hotel Kempinski was where he was staying for the media and for everybody.
Yes.
So they'd all hang around there, all the fans would all hang around the foyer of the Hotel Kempinski, but Bowie never stayed in the Hotel Kempinski. He always stayed in the Askanischer Hof, in the Bowie suite that the Hathaway had made up just for David Bowie. So that, you know, like, he knew he felt comfortable in this little kind of like a little family-run hotel, you know, in the dining room where you had your breakfast or sat for coffee or whatever in the afternoon. The entire wall was photographs from the 1920s and 30s of and 50s even, right, of Germany's, and a few international as well, but like mostly German film stars of that period.
Yeah.
All, every single photograph is signed to Arthur, you know,
wow,
from Marlene Dietrich or whoever, you know.
So Bowie must have loved that.
And of course, it was, you see that room and that, yeah, and all those photographs, and it's like, you know why Bowie doesn't want to stay in the Hotel Kempinski. He wants to sit here with all this lot, you know, with all these people that he admires, and looks at the photographs of these people. They're portraits that have been taken by a professional photographer, you know, and that's what he wants to have on the front cover of Heroes. He wants to have that image, like that kind of 1920s, 30s black and white photograph, plus the images he's seen in the Brücke Museum. And he's mixed both of them together, and that's Heroes, black and white photo.
That's how we get that very striking cover by Sukita, the photographer.
He didn't know which pose he would have to do, right? But when you see that one, you know, he was like the memory of like, oh, that's the image I've seen in the Brücke Museum. I'm going to do that. That was the minute it was presented. He knew that's where he'd been looking.
It's a perfect synthesis, isn't it? I suppose old 1920s, 1930s, black and white.
Total.
Very stiff, formal photos. So and then
beautifully arranged. Yes. You know, and then the fact that he's doing this pose, which is, yeah, you know, it's like, it's like
sort of rock and roll from the painter, isn't it? It's that
so,
holding the hand up.
It's so brilliant.
That kind of sums it up. It sums up the album, fusing together the past, his present day environment. I think the painting, you know, the history of the painting that you just told me, yeah, really says that as well, taking something from the past and then bringing it into the present day and, you know, using the wall metaphor to reflect on what's happening around him in reality. Yeah. What, if any, thoughts do you have on the actual music? Because the music, again, in Heroes is really, really expressive. And again, it's quite eccentric in its layering and its makeup. You know, it's... You hear a second of it, you know what song this is.
It's an anthem now, you know. The minute you hear that first bass line, it's like you know what's coming. Fabulous piece of music. I mean, like the Robert Fripp's guitar is irreplaceable. You can't, you know, like I've seen many versions of Heroes being played, you know, but it's nothing like Robert Fripp's version. You know, even though you get some very close approximations of what it is, none of them can do it by Robert.
I've seen live versions when, of course, guitarists, I mean, the most recent tours he did with Earl Slick and people, obviously doing their best to get that sound, but you're right, no one can quite get it. No matter how many 21st century gadgets and gizmos you have, you just can't replicate that sound.
You can't.
Because this track, I believe, was recorded live. The whole band, the whole thing, where we were
a few weeks ago
in the great big Meistersaal where this track was recorded, a colossal wooden paneled room. And Robert Fripp had his guitar, plugged it into Brian's synthesizer, which was then plugged into a Marshall guitar amp with a large speaker cabinet. And that was cranked up very high. And Brian Eno was playing that feed on a joystick as it came in. So that's Fripp's guitar going through tons and tons of processing and then actually being manipulated live.
That's why I get all the beep.
Exactly. That's Eno modulating the guitar as it's fed into the mixing board. And then you have a lot of effects on Dennis Davis. Now, Dennis Davis, I think every time I do a podcast about Bowie where Dennis Davis has played drums, we always have to take a moment just to pay respect to Dennis Davis, one of the greatest rock drummers of all time, one of the greatest drummers of all time, actually, not just a rock drummer. Something interesting that Visconti did during the Hero sessions was putting Dennis Davis on a 5-foot-high platform
at
the back of the room and then having the rest of the band pretty much at the level of his kick drum. George Murray, the bass player, was always talking about how he just felt that kick drum banging because they all had very specific positions. So Carlos Alomar, if you imagine Dennis Davis sitting at the back of that hall, Alomar would be on his left and George Murray would be to his right and Bowie would be somewhere in the middle. So it's fascinating when you think about how they would play
live, with all this live processing going on. And then, of course, very famously in this track is Tony Visconti's miking system, where I think it was three mics he had. And as loud a Bowie sound, he'd trigger those mics.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, that meant he had to then sustain that volume in the latter part of the song, because having triggered that mic, he would then have to keep that almost hysterical pitch going. It's amazing.
And they made that song up as well.
Yeah.
Like Bowie's vocals for Heroes was pretty much last minute, as far as I can remember. You know, inspired by all these things.
It's a song that has subsequently become an anthem. I don't think it was originally intended to be a sort of big stadium.
No. I don't think he thought the slightest. I don't think I'm going to make it, you know, it's like, not, I'm going to write Christmas number one or something. So it's like, you know, it's like he made this song and it was just part of his album. It was like the title track of the album, but that was probably what all he thought it was going to ever be, you know. But in the meantime, it's become a kind of like, it's covered by so many people in the meantime. Yes. And each one tries to put their own sentiment, if you like, in the song, but it's a hard act to follow.
I will be clear.
To do a remix of Heroes, which I'd love to attempt to do a remix of Heroes, just to see where I could take the song, but keep everything that's in the song in the song. Take all the elements that are there and remix them, of course, because so it sounds exactly the same as the original, but it would be different.
You should do it.
Well, it's not to me, that is. I can't, I remember they released us some time, I think it was like the early, late 90s, early 2000s, they released some kind of remixes, CD of remixes, and there was a thing, a David Guetta remix of Heroes.
Yes.
Because I'm in 2000, I said, it's a David Guetta remix of Heroes, and it was nothing of the kind.
Yeah.
You know, and I was so disappointed. I didn't know what to expect from David Guetta, but I expected something that, other than that. Yeah. It just sounded like he'd taken the track and sampled it and just kind of like dropped it in under a 4/4 kick. And I'm thinking, that's not what it's about. The track has this emotion in it.
Mm.
Right from the start of the song, it has an emotion in it, which comes this crescendo at the end, you know, and it's like to do a remix where you still keep that tension and the way it builds, you know, it have to be, you have to take time on it. It's not something you can it's not just you take a backing track of a techno loop and then you just drop in the vocal, you know, that's not what it's about. It's about taking the whole thing as a piece of work and making it into something which, you know, might reach a different audience because of the sound that you've given it.
What do you reckon of the French and German versions? Because I think the German version for me is just magnificent.
I thought it was quirky enough to be good, really, somehow, the German. The thing is, when I first heard it, I didn't speak any German at all. Yeah. So when I first heard it, I was like, wow, David Bowie singing in German. He's living in Berlin and suddenly he's singing in a song in German. I already had the UK release of Heroes. But the minute I heard that in Germany they'd released the German version with a German lyric on it, I had to have that too. That became the album for me. I hardly ever listened to the UK version of the song. I always listen to the German one. And you know, the cut is far better. The actual master of the German one is far louder and more dynamic than the UK version, actually. Playing back to back, you'll notice it. It's like, wow. It's like the UK one sounds good, but the German one sounds a little bit better. It's got it's rounder somehow, you know, it has more depth to it, it's warmer. And then you sing in German and it's like, wow, it's like, so he went to Germany and he's instantly been able to sing a song in German.
How clever he is.
He's like, wow, brilliant, you know, like, fantastic. And then they got the French single and it was...
That always baffled me. Why the French version? That didn't sit...
Because it was European, you know, he was doing Trans-Europa Express, you know.
Well... Okay, so moving on now. So after Heroes, the big epic anthem, it's another sort of anthem. This is Sons of the Silent.
Sons of the Silent. It couldn't be done. Baby, I'll never let you go. All I see is all I know. Let's take another way down.
Sons of sound and sons of sound.
I always felt this song slightly gets overshadowed by being coming straight after Heroes. But what's your take on this one?
I love Sons of the Silent Age. I thought it was a brilliant image somehow for me, you know, Sons of the Silent Age. Because I associate the song with some like metropolis or something like that. Yeah, that's what I kind of
screamed.
Initially kind of like thought that the song was about. I love silent movies. And I thought this was an homage, if you like, to this kind of like Weimar Republic era. Yeah,
that's interesting. Nick Pegg, who's done a few of these episodes, he talks a lot about Bowie's referencing the cinema, and especially in Hunky Dory, you know, tracks like Life on Mars.
Yeah,
it's a central metaphor for him. It's a visual metaphor.
Yeah.
And following on this interpretation of Sons of the Silent Age as being an homage to the silent screen era.
Yeah.
Yeah, that could really work.
You know, this period, you know, there was this couple of cinemas here that, like the Nordausgang, which was literally across the street from where he lived. They would show on a regular basis old movies. Mm. Like they'd show Metropolis, they'd show M.
Yes, Fritz Lang.
Yeah, Fritz Lang, you know. They'd show film with Jack Benny in it and Carol Lombard, which in German is called Heil Hamlet or something like this.
Heil Hamlet.
Sein oder nicht sein, to be or not to be. That was the subtitle, Heil Hamlet. They show these kind of movies in this cinema. It was literally across the road from where David Bowie lived. So I'm pretty sure that when they were showing the silent films, he probably went there to watch a silent movie. And no one would have known. You know what I mean? Black cap, mustache, and check shirt and jeans. It would have just been some bloke, you know, probably. And the woman sitting at the cash desk there would never in a million years considered this bloke who keeps coming to the cinema as David Bowie.
There's a theory on BowieBible.com that this was a very Jacques Brel song.
Mm.
So there's a huge Brel influence in this particular track. And on Bowie Bible, they say, but Bowie's Sons of the Silent Age are mysterious figures, mute and devoid of expression, who tacitly observe, make love, and cry just once. They wage war, they're immortal, but just go to sleep one day. And they point out that last line was a direct lift from a musical review, Jacques Brel is alive and well and living in Paris, which contains a song called Les Vieux, Old Folks. And that song has a line which is, the old folks never die, they just put down their heads and go to sleep one day. So given the fact that Bowie was already a big Brel clown, it's an intriguing twist on that. But I think you're right. I think the silent screen, the cinema, you were saying just now about the hotel as well, which was surrounded, the walls were surrounded in these slack.
The Sons of the Silent.
Yeah.
I mean, like most of the people on this wall were like, you know, people that Arthur knew personally, right? It was like, you know, these like actors and stuff. You know, it wasn't like he just met them and had a selfie. It was like these were people who he actually knew, you know. And I think that Bowie might have been very heavily influenced by that, as much as he was influenced by the actual films as well, but also, you know, having worked in France as well, you know, and there's all these, as everything is always, there's inspiration from many different parts come together and become then manifest themselves in the song.
Well, we're seeing that here in, I think, pretty much every song we've talked about so far. We're seeing disparate influences. We're seeing the past, the present, you know, the romance of a bygone cinematic Weimar era, and then the reality of cold 1970s divided Berlin, you know, all these things coming into play, as well as his kaleidoscopic frame of reference anyway, which he already had.
Books and films.
Yeah, exactly. The constant, there's that famous story when he was filming The Man Who Fell to Earth.
Yeah.
He goes to New Mexico to film and takes a couple of trunks of books to read. You know, he has this manic need to devour information. Yeah. So constantly, all the time, this process is going on of more data, more raw information feeding in. But I really think that Sons of the Silent Age will have a connection to that hotel.
Definitely.
You know.
Without a doubt. So the hotel and the fact that it's not, you know, the cinema across the street, I'm pretty sure.
Well, last track on... So we're thinking vinyl terms. So last track on side one, obviously, and Blackout. There are a number of theories about this. It's fairly well documented that he had a colossal panic attack when Angie visited him. The two events were probably related. And he had to go to the British hospital, the military hospital. Here he had he just passed out. He was in a dreadful state. And the doctors there sort of said, okay, you need to slow down a bit. So blackout, that's one thing there. Apparently there'd been a big power cut in New York in July 77, a massive power cut that lasted, I think, 12 hours or so in New York.
Yeah.
And he's on record saying that was the starting point of this track.
I read about that. That was the news bulletin was the thing that kind of gave him the title.
American military news was probably all he would be able to get on his TV. I mean, in terms of English language.
Not on TV. You could get it on the radio.
Right.
AFN, American Forces Network. The only TV you could watch here was West German TV.
Right. There wasn't any English language, I mean, access to English language television.
If you had an American television, an NTSC TV, you might be able to access, if you lived in Kreuzberg, you could access the US forces. Their signal, but their signal was more or less confined to barracks. It wasn't even a very, very wide transmission area, but you had to have an NTSC TV.
So you didn't have access to that?
I didn't know. I had a British television, which my dad had given to Einstürz und der Neubau, my playing in the Hacienda, and my dad went down to see them play and brought them a television. They'd never seen it before. He thought it was interesting to see a band from Berlin, and it was like, they were very interesting, he said. And he gave them this TV, and when I got it, they brought it back in their van, and when I got this TV, it didn't really work here in Berlin.
Right.
It was like, I could only get the second programme of East German TV. It's like the BBC Two of East Germany, you know. So that's the only thing I could see. And even that picture looked like it was like in a snowstorm. So he probably wasn't really watching much TV, I don't think.
I'd heard a story somewhere. He and Iggy were sitting in the lounge one day and they heard the test card or whatever for American forces, which was a dun 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 dun. And he picks up a ukulele. Dun, 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 which is apparently where that comes from.
Yeah, Lost for Life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was like a little like...
They had a certain themes. And also at the end of it, if you turn the dial of your radio to the very end, you got this like mishmash of things. Like one side, it was the Germans going 1:25, 1:30, and then on the other end, it would be like, and he's like, what is that one? And I only found out when I started going to having some American Army personnel as friends, right? They said, oh, that's a signal which when if it breaks or changes, it means that we have to go back to barracks and could be the Third World War is about to start. So that was that.
They can't keep that all in the background.
That constantly was always running.
Yeah.
And if you were anywhere and you wanted to find out what's going on, if you listen to that constant repetition of a bleeping sound, if it changed, then it meant that there was the war.
So Lee was kicking off.
Something was happening.
This is what was available to him in terms of media.
He had West Berlin radio, British Forces radio, or AFN, American Forces radio. That's all he could listen to, really.
Well, let's flip the record over, as it were, and get into side two, which begins with this fantastic, evocative, very atmospheric. Now, this to me could have been recorded at a May Day rally, East Berlin, V2 Schneider.
First saw that title, V2 Schneider, I automatically thought V2 is referencing the vengeance weapon of Second World War. And the Schneider bit was Florian Schneider from Kraftwerk. And I thought that it was a bit of this late 1940s version of German science. Going into the space age was
very epic, isn't it?
It's an homage, if you like. Kraftwerk also had referenced Bowie as well in Trans-Europe Express. So I think that he, in a sense, getting his own back and referencing Kraftwerk in this piece of music. But also at the same time, you know, he'd obviously been listening to like Kraftwerk and listening to Tangerine Dream. This kind of intermingling kind of sort of ideas within that piece of music, you know, that obviously he'd been inspired by this idea, because it sounded like Kraftwerk, sounded like super futuristic even.
Oh, it's completely an homage to Kraftwerk, and he was absolutely enthralled to them. And like you were saying earlier, this is something that would have been building up over the years with this fascination with this group of artists who did everything differently to Anglo rock and pop.
I remember seeing Kraftwerk. They played Autobahn, I think, on Tomorrow's World, and that clip they played on Top of the Pops. And I remember seeing that.
Next year, Kraftwerk hoped to eliminate the keyboards altogether and build jackets with electronic lapels, which can be played by touch.
It just sounded so abstract.
I believe that he'd wanted Kraftwerk to work with him on, was it Low, maybe, or Station to Station?
Yeah.
But they couldn't.
Probably Low.
Yeah.
Probably
Low. And they were unavailable for whatever reason.
Because it would make it a man's machine.
Bowie said at the time, in 1978, Bowie said, "When I go to Dusseldorf, they take me to cake shops, and we have huge pastries. They wear their suits, a little bit like Gilbert and George. God, whatever happened to those two? I used to really like them. But whenever I came over to Europe, because the first tour I ever did with Europe, I got myself a Mercedes to drive myself around in, and Florian saw it and he said, 'What a wonderful car.' And Florian said, 'Yeah, car always lasts longer.' I don't know what that means, but anyway, there was clearly a sympathy between them." Yeah. And you're right. They mention Bowie and Iggy in Trans-Europe Express, which contains the lines, "From station to station, back to Dusseldorf City, meet Iggy Pop and David Bowie." So there was clearly a synergy between the two.
Yeah, for sure. This whole thing with Eno having worked with Van Cluster and stuff that introduced Bowie to, like, you've got to listen to this. You know?
Yeah.
You listen to this. Have you heard that? You know. And I think that definitely brought everything together, all these strands to get together. And this is just his homage.
It's the second consecutive album where he's doing this side one traditional songs, side two instrumentals, which hadn't really been done before, had it? And it must have been quite groundbreaking for him to explore
this new approach to music making.
I love the idea that, especially with Low, first of all, you know, like the one side this and one side the other side that. And I love the fact that it carried that through in Heroes as well. That one side was all the songs, the other side was like mainly just instrumentals, you know, like ideas. It was almost like a film soundtrack.
Yeah.
You know, like this is you got the songs, but this is the film soundtrack. This is the thing that you're going to listen to while you're walking around the streets. You know?
Well, talking of walking around the streets, listening to Bowie.
I was very lucky that I was given an early version of a Sony Walkman in the late 70s, early 80s. And I remember like recording Heroes onto the cassette and then walking around the streets with my own film soundtrack on. And I only had like Low and Heroes on.
Yeah.
And only the instrumentals, none of the songs.
Really? So you just had
the
instrumental sides and that was your soundtrack. Where would you walk around?
Just like Fröneberg and Kreuzberg.
Yeah. You know,
at night. In the gas lanterns and the dingy streets of like Chamisso-Platz and around that, it's like the Tempelhof airfield and stuff area around there where I lived, you know, I lived in Kreuzberg. It was like the perfect soundtrack for left city somehow. It was derelict, bullet-ridden, grey. East Berlin was a slightly more damaged, but like West Berlin was grey and bullet-riddled and shrapnel-riddled. And like the whole house where I lived, you know, you go in the backyard, all the windows have been incinerated because there'd been a firebombing on the building next door. Yeah. And the heat was so intense that it had melted all the paint on the doors. And they'd not given it since 1945, it had not had a lick of paint, you know, so you could still see this. And where someone in one of the windows had obviously been like a sniper or something, and they'd kind of shot all around the windows. So it was like bullet riddled around the windows. And this is the kind of Berlin that I was experiencing when I first came here, this kind of derelict, shot to pieces city, everything grey. And in the wintertime, you had this smell in the air from the brown coal that the people would burn in the ovens in the homes to keep warm. So this whole city had this kind of like brown coal smog, which kind of hung around and gave this kind of mist around the gas lanterns in this dingy streets, you know. And you have this sound playing in your headphones, you know, walking around this street like, I was like, wow, I can't wait till next winter. Honestly, I love winter and it's not changed ever.
You still love winter.
I still love winter in Berlin, and I have this album on my phone now, you know, and then listen to it in winter exactly the same.
You still get that after all these years?
Yeah.
It's still walk?
Because I still live in the same place, same area, so it's still exactly the same. So I can still experience this feeling of like, you know, it doesn't smell anymore like coal, you know, because people have central heating these days. But we still have the gas lanterns and the dingy streets.
It's an element of Berlin that still exists after all these years. The city's changed so much over the last 40, 50 years, become a lot more cleaned up. But in Sense of Doubt especially, I don't know if it's that tolling figure, but he captures something endlessly. It's so evocative the way that you describe it. Bowie and you sort of going at the same thing, some sort of darkness.
The uncertainty.
The uncertainty.
Like when they made it, they were like, they didn't know really what they were, what one side was doing one thing and the other side was doing another bit, you know, and about it. They were kind of like doing things like they didn't know where it was going to take them, this song. You know, you come to Berlin and you've got no idea that you're going to be staying here. I mean, I came here to Berlin with no objective at all. You know, I didn't know how long I was going to stay here.
You came here to go record shopping.
Do you know what I mean? That's just
meet with your back.
2 days and go, you know. The sense of doubt in that title sort of says it all in a sense. It's like, you know, don't want to go back. I don't want to stay.
Yeah.
You know, should I go or sort of stay? And in the end, the city won.
The city won out.
I don't regret it for one single moment. You know, the whole experience of actually living in this city from the moment I got here, I wouldn't change it for the world, you know.
tomorrow belongs to those that can hear it coming.
New album from David Bowie on RCA Records.